Southern Fraud True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Over 500,000 people went missing last year. That number has been dropping steadily for decades, but it is still a sobering statistic. About 60% of these cases are juveniles, although they may not get the attention you would think. If you follow true crime, you not only know the statistics, you know about missing white woman syndrome. There are certain cases that capture the public's attention, which certainly affects investigations. When we think of people who go missing, who don't get as much attention, they are usually adults. Adults with mental health issues or addiction. People who are unhoused or have a history of running away. When 31-year-old Mike Williams went missing in December of the year 2000, he did not fit the normal statistics. He was a well-respected businessman. He was a devoted husband and father. And still, at least one investigator joked that he might be chilling on a beach in the Bahamas. Because when an adult who seemingly has everything going for him disappears, the prevailing theory is that they left on their own. And to that, what duty do law enforcement have in proving an adult walked away from their life? Do they spend the same amount of resources trying to prove that as they would if there had been foul play? We would like to think so. Even if they walked away, they left a grieving and confused family searching for answers. In Mike's case, his disappearance was immediately considered a hunting accident. He had gone duck hunting that morning in Lake Seminole, Florida. So unfortunately, when his body wasn't found, his case lost traction. It would take 17 years to find out the truth about Mike Williams. And it wasn't because law enforcement kept searching. It was because Mike's mother refused to give up. She knew her son didn't walk away from his life. And she did not believe in her heart that he died in an accident. Welcome to episode 151, The Murder of Mike Williams. I want to take a moment to apologize in advance for my voice this week. I have been sick since CrimeCon, almost 2 weeks ago, and I'm still on antibiotics. I waited as long as I could to record this episode, but my voice is definitely still scratchy and may get worse as we go, but I'll do my best, so bear with me. Located in the Florida Panhandle, the area that makes up Tallahassee originated as Anhika, the capital of Apalachee, a native tribe of people who farmed the land. In 1823, after the Spanish stole the Apalachee people's land, and General Andrew Jackson burned Anhika down, Tallahassee became the capital of Florida. Named after the Muskogean word for old town, Tallahassee is known for its rolling red hills, which is vastly different from the largely flat peninsula part of Florida. There are some 48 lakes in the Tallahassee city limits, offering residents and visitors the chance to boat, canoe, hunt, and fish. Because many of the lakes are shallow and highly vegetated, it's common for residents to travel around 60 miles northwest of Tallahassee to Lake Seminole. Encompassing 37,500 acres of water, the lake is a great place to fish for largemouth bass and crappie and hunt for waterfowl. But the one thing visitors have to know about Lake Seminole is that it's home to many alligators, which have known to grow to nearly 14 feet long and more than 600 pounds. There are so many alligators that authorities recommend visitors steer clear of any areas of marsh or brush. When Mike Williams said goodbye to his wife on December 16th in the year 2000, he was going duck hunting on Lake Seminole. He left early because he and Denise were leaving later that afternoon to go to Apalachicola to celebrate their 6th wedding anniversary. To friends and family, the Williams couple was very happy. They were planning a trip to Hawaii later in the year, and more importantly, they were ready to have another child. Their daughter was about a year and a half old, but they still told family that they were ready for another baby. Denise wasn't worried. Mike was an experienced hunter, and as far as getting home in time for their anniversary trip, that didn't worry her either. Mike was the most dependable man. He was the kind of husband who always put his wife first, and he would never upset Denise by being late for a trip. If anything, he would never want to worry her, much less be late for their anniversary. Mike had promised to be home by noon, and when he wasn't there as promised, Denise was immediately worried. She didn't wait to see if he was just running late. She immediately put out the word that Mike was missing. Even though Denise trusted her husband, she was well aware of the dangers of Lake Seminole. Accidents happened. The lake is infested with alligators. Where was Mike Williams? I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Jerry Michael Williams, who went by Mike, was born on October 16, 1969 in Tallahassee, the largest city in the Florida Panhandle region. A center for trade and agriculture, Tallahassee boasts a vibrant college community that includes Florida State University, Florida A&M, and several other smaller schools. Mike's mother, Cheryl, worked as a daycare worker, and his father, Jerry Sr., as a Greyhound bus driver. The Williams family wasn't rich, but they were comfortable. They chose to raise their two sons in a trailer and save for their education instead. They were able to send Mike and his older brother Nick to private school. Mike attended high school at North Florida Christian School, where he was very popular. One friend, Scott, told 48 Hours that Mike was, quote, "the kind of person that will do anything and everything for you." Although Mike was the type of guy who would hang out with anyone, he spent most of his time with Brian Winchester, a fellow freshman he met on their very first day of high school. They bonded over their mutual interest in hunting and would grow to become lifelong best friends. Mike's mother, Cheryl, often told the media how much her son had loved Brian. It wasn't long before Mike started dating a stoic, proper Christian girl named Denise Merrill. They were a power couple at North Florida Christian School, dominating the yearbook. Mike was voted best personality and was a standout athlete and student council president, and Denise was voted best dressed and was a cheerleader. Mike and Denise often went on double dates with Brian and his girlfriend Kathy, a fellow cheerleader at North Florida Christian School. The four students were so close that after high school graduation, they all attended Florida State University together. Denise majored in accounting, while Mike majored in city planning and political science. Before he graduated, Mike started working at Ketchum Realty and Appraisal Group, where he was known to be a hard worker and a straight shooter. Upon graduating in 1991, Mike accepted a full-time position as a real estate appraiser with Ketchum Realty, and Denise went to work as an accountant. In 1994, both couples married, with Mike and Denise tying the knot on December 17th. Brian served as Mike's best man. Mike's boss, Clay Ketchum, later told 48 Hours that Mike loved Denise and would do anything for her. He would even leave work to pump her gas whenever she wanted him to. Mike's co-workers loved to joke that they wanted to be married to Mike. In 1999, Brian and Kathy Winchester welcomed a son. That same year, Denise and Mike welcomed a daughter they named Ansley. They loved their baby girl more than anything in the world. She was their pride and joy. Both Brian and Mike now had children, but that didn't stop them from going on hunting trips, oftentimes together. So it came as no surprise when Mike asked Denise if he could go duck hunting the morning of Saturday, December 16th, 2000. He was double-checking because they had plans that evening. They were going away on a weekend trip to celebrate their 6th wedding anniversary. They were going to Apalachicola to a nice hotel on the bay. Denise said she was okay with Mike hunting as long as he was home by noon so they could pack and leave on time. In the very early morning hours of Saturday, December 16th, Mike loaded up his boat with duck hunting supplies, a shotgun, ammunition, decoys, and waders. In case you don't fish or know much about it, waders are waterproof boots that extend to your hips, waist, or chest, depending on the style. Sort of waterproof overalls, so you can wade into the water and fish instead of standing on the bank. Anyway, then Mike drove an hour to Lake Seminole, a 37,500-acre reservoir that borders Florida in the southwest corner of Georgia. When Mike didn't return home by noon, Denise was worried, so she called her father. Eventually, word got to Brian, and he jumped into action. Brian and his father, Marcus Winchester, drove out to Lake Seminole. It didn't take long before they found Mike's Ford Bronco and boat trailer near a remote, undeveloped landing, not suited for launching a boat. It didn't make sense for Mike to be parked there. He would have had to drag his boat down through the mud in order to launch it into the lake. There were perfectly good boat ramps nearby that Mike was known to use. Brian and his dad called authorities, and the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission were put in charge of the search, with support from Jackson County Sheriff deputies. The initial theory was that Mike had a boating accident while out on the lake. The area of the lake near where Mike's truck was located is known as Stump Field, so authorities thought his boat may have struck a tree stump, causing Mike to jolt forward, falling overboard. This type of occurrence was not unusual at Lake Seminole, so it seemed plausible in authorities' eyes. If Mike fell overboard, he likely would have drowned, either from getting caught under vegetation or from his waders filling with water, sucking him to the bottom of the lake. Authorities knew that if their drowning theory was correct, Mike's boat would be somewhere on the lake. They just had to find it. Friends and family members showed up to help, because Denise was beside herself, emotionally distressed and sobbing. She never went to the lake. Authorities planned to immediately begin the search for Mike, but they had to call it off temporarily until a storm passed through. When it was safe to begin the search, family, friends, and authorities focused on the closest 10 acres of water near where Mike's truck was found. On December 17th at 2:30 a.m., Brian and his father located Mike's boat, which had come to rest only 225 feet from the remote landing near Mike's truck. Inside the boat was Mike's shotgun, decoys, and life jackets. Because his gun was still in its case, it appeared Mike hadn't been in the process of hunting when he fell overboard. His ammunition and waders were not in the boat. Mike must have had them on when he drowned. There was no blood, signs of a struggle, or foul play, and it didn't look like Mike hit a stump because there was no bark in the propellers. Using 15 boats and one helicopter, authorities kept searching the lake for Mike, who they now presumed was dead. They knew that if he drowned, his body would most likely float to the surface. Brian, who was still helping search, kept telling people that he couldn't be there when Mike's body was found. It would be too upsetting. After 3 days of searching, authorities started to question why they hadn't found Mike's body. There had been around 80 known drowning deaths in the lake, and every single body had been recovered, so it just did not make sense. But they kept looking, dedicated to recovering Mike. On the 10th day, authorities conducted a grid search, during which they found a hat. Brian, who was at the lake to help search, identified it as belonging to Mike. He even had a photograph of them together where Mike was seen wearing the hat. Because every other known drowning victim had been located, authorities added to their theory of what happened to Mike. Now, they figured that after he drowned, his body was eaten by alligators, of which there were hundreds in Lake Seminole. That would explain why they couldn't find his body. Denise Williams immediately accepted the alligator theory and scheduled a memorial service, which was held on February 11th, 2001, the day after the search for Mike was officially called off. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from one of our sponsors. In the summer, I love hanging by the pool, and summer doesn't last forever, so I definitely don't want to waste my time at the grocery store, much less with meal planning and cooking. With Splendid Spoon, you can make more time to enjoy the season and feel great with plant-based meals that require no prep time. Splendid Spoon sends delicious, plant-based, ready-to-eat meals and snacks right to your door. Splendid Spoon fits perfectly into my hectic life. I love starting my mornings with a mango guava smoothie. And Splendid Spoon meals are shipped right to your door, ready to eat. You'll only lift a finger to press start on your microwave. Splendid Spoon fits into any schedule, and there's a meal plan for everyone, especially since you customize your own plan. Splendid Spoon makes clean, delicious food made with real ingredients and spices. Enjoy a fresh take on classic dishes like their fan favorite vegan meatballs and marinara noodles. They've got plenty of smoothies, grain bowls, soup bowls, and noodle bowls for you to discover. Plus, eating plant-based food can come with a wealth of benefits, like improved energy, sleep, digestion, and complexion. Eat well and enjoy more of your summer with Splendid Spoon. Get started today and save on an entire week of ready-made plant-based meals. Just go to splendidspoon.com/SFTC for $50 off your first box when you subscribe. That's $50 off at splendidspoon.com/SFTC. By February, Denise was really struggling to make ends meet. She no longer had Mike's salary, and she was raising a toddler by herself. And without a body or proof that Mike was actually dead, it would be difficult for her to get any life insurance payouts. In hopes of getting some financial relief, Denise requested that Mike be declared dead. A court hearing was scheduled for the end of June 2001. On June 22nd, around a week before the court hearing, a fisherman was out on Lake Seminole in Stump Field when he found Mike's waders floating near the surface of the water. Still hanging around the waist of the waders was Mike's pouch filled with shotgun shells. It was a surprising find considering divers had spent 56 days going over every inch of that area. It is also very important to note that the waders were found partially inside out, as if Mike had taken them off. There were no bite marks or other tears indicating that the waders had been pulled off of Mike by an alligator or any other kind of predator. Finally, on February 11, 2004, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, FDLE, opened a case on Mike and started re-interviewing anyone who had been part of the search. It was the first time a law enforcement agency investigated Mike's disappearance in any criminal way. It became clear very quickly that the whole case had been compromised from the beginning. Because everyone was so sure that Mike's disappearance was related to a boating accident, the original investigating agencies had not been paying as close attention as they would have if they thought foul play was involved. That meant certain people weren't interviewed and leads were not recognized. And to make matters worse, potential evidence, like Mike's truck and boat, had been released to the family without being searched for any DNA, fingerprints, or any other kind of evidence. By not treating Mike's disappearance as suspicious, the initial investigating agencies missed a lot of red flags. Let's start with Mike's boat, which was found with its engine off in the on position with the gas tank full. While that in itself isn't exactly super suspicious, it does not add up with the theory that Mike was out on the lake using the boat when he fell off and drowned. If the initial investigating authorities had contacted the manufacturer of Mike's boat engine, they would have found out that if there was no one to guide the motor, the boat would have run around in circles until the gas ran out. After that, according to weather reports, the empty boat would have been blown into a westerly direction by the storm that rolled in that day, meaning his boat would have come to a rest across the lake on the opposite shore, not 225 feet from his vehicle. If authorities had interviewed Mike's friends and family, they would have heard that he was a very safe and careful hunter. He never went hunting alone, He always had someone with him, and he never ever wore his waders on the boat. He would wait to put them on once he was in his hunting location. One of his friends, Damon, told the Tallahassee Democrat that Mike was, quote, obsessed with safety. So much so that Mike would lecture his friends, like Damon, about how you shouldn't ever wear your waders in the boat. Why? Because Mike thought if he fell in the lake and his waders filled up with water, he would be sucked down to the bottom where he would drown. With the drowning after Mike's waders filled up with water theory starting to lose credibility, the FDLE spoke with alligator specialists who said it was very unlikely that Mike was eaten by alligators. For one, it was winter, and North Florida alligators brumate in cold weather, which means that they slow down and become sluggish, sort of like hibernation, but for cold-blooded animals. And if by some crazy chance an alligator did eat Mike, it was impossible that no evidence was left behind. So if Mike's death was not accidental, then what happened to him? The FDLE now had two new theories. Either Mike left and disappeared intentionally for his own reasons, or he was murdered. Sadly, there were a lot of people who were banking on the first option. Jackson County Sheriff's Investigator Derek Wester told the Tallahassee Democrat, quote, "It's like the Bigfoot. A lot of people think he is down in the Bahamas sitting on a beach." However, some weren't so sure. Mike's boss, Patty Ketchum, told 48 Hours, quote, "Mike has not run off. I mean, he loved his family and he adored his daughter, adored her. So Mike did not run off. This was not some elaborate ruse." For the murder theory, investigators did at least come up with one solid suspect, Mike's best friend, Brian Winchester. Florida State Attorney's Office investigator Tully Sparkman told A&E's Cold Case Files that while sifting through the case, he found Brian to be very suspicious. Brian had been present for too many important parts of the investigation. He and his father Marcus found Mike's boat, and he had been at the scene to identify Mike's hat. Investigators started looking further into Brian and found that less than 2 years after Mike disappeared, Brian divorced his wife Kathy and started dating Denise Williams. It wasn't long before Brian moved into the home Denise had once shared with Mike. They ended up marrying on December 3, 2005, 5 years after Mike went missing and 2 years after the new investigation was opened. Investigators questioned Brian's ex, Kathy, about Brian and Denise's relationship. And Kathy gave them the goods. She told them she had suspected Denise and Brian were having an affair before Mike went missing. Now, investigators were wondering if Denise was involved as well. They looked into Mike's life insurance policies and found that only 19 days after he went missing, Denise filed to receive Mike's life insurance policies, which she was the sole beneficiary of, $250,000 through work, an extra $500,000 policy taken out after the birth of his daughter, and a $1 million policy, which had been set up around 6 months before Mike's disappearance. There were multiple suspicious things about the policies. Mike had not yet been declared dead at that date, and the investigation wasn't even halfway over, so it was odd that she was trying to cash out the policies, which totaled $1.75 million. I guess, to be fair, the $500,000 policy was set to expire at the end of December 2000, but she still had 2 weeks. What was the rush? Most importantly for investigators, the insurance agent who sold Mike the $1 million policy was none other than Brian Winchester. While investigating the possibility that Denise and Brian were involved in Mike's disappearance, authorities found out that on two separate occasions, Denise confronted Cheryl Williams about the pressure she was putting on authorities to investigate Mike's death. Cheryl is Mike's mother. The first confrontation occurred in August 2001 after a local newspaper published an article featuring five missing locals, including Mike. According to an appeal document, Denise called Cheryl, screaming that she never wanted to hear Mike's name again or see Mike's picture in the paper because she had to get on with her life. Investigators discovered that Denise told Cheryl that if she continued pushing for a criminal investigation, she would not let her see her granddaughter. Cheryl later said it was at that moment she knew Denise had something to do with Mike's death. She told Denise that she would not stop pursuing justice for her son. She was more determined than ever to find out what had happened to Mike. And Cheryl never saw her granddaughter again, although she later spent years writing open letters and recording videos, which she posted on social media, hoping Ansley would see them. But she never reached out to her grandma. The second confrontation occurred in January 2005, when Brian and Denise went to Cheryl's house. Denise told her if she stopped pushing for an investigation, Cheryl could see her granddaughter again. Cheryl's other son, Nick, was present, and he told Brian and Denise that he and his mother just wanted to know what they had done to Mike. Brian and Denise left in a huff, supposedly outraged by the accusation. Everything investigators had learned prompted them to ask Brian and Denise to come in for questioning. Brian told investigators that on the morning of December 16th, he was supposed to go hunting with his father-in-law, but he had accidentally slept in. Detective Derek Wester told 48 Hours that when they spoke to Denise, quote, "There's no emotion. There's no softening up. There's nothing. I mean, she's just matter-of-fact and cold." But still, the interviews did not bring the FDLE any closer to solving Mike's disappearance. In 2008, they announced that Mike's disappearance and/or death was not an accident. They now believed foul play had been involved. But that's as far as the FDLE got with the case. There was not enough evidence for a search warrant, let alone charges, so they stopped pursuing the case. However, investigators did not completely give up. They continued keeping tabs on Brian and Denise, hoping they would slip up. Cheryl continued pressuring investigators to look at Mike's case, but they ignored her. When she realized they weren't going to help, she started writing a letter to the governor every day for 9 years. Cheryl sent 2,600 letters. She never received a reply in 9 years. One day, Cheryl called the governor's office and asked why she never got a reply. She was told that the letters had all been forwarded, unopened, to the FDLE. Cheryl was devastated, yet she still did not give up. She continued trying to find answers. Meanwhile, in 2012, investigators received word that Denise and Brian had separated due to their constant fighting and Brian's infidelity. Jennifer Portman, a reporter for the Tallahassee Democrat, told 48 Hours that Brian believed he was a sex addict. Two of Brian's friends told 48 Hours that Brian was also very adamant that he absolutely did not want to be divorced, that he was miserable without her. He tried to make it work with Denise by going to therapy and undergoing treatment. He was, quote, "jumping through all these hoops, trying to do all these things to get her back." But Denise wanted nothing to do with him. After she filed for divorce in 2015, 10 years after they married, Denise remained as stoic and put together as always. But Brian seemed stressed and was aging very quickly. That gave investigators an idea on how they could get the ball moving on Mike's case. On the night of August 4, 2016, investigators paid a visit to Brian, during which they lied and said that Denise planned to tell them what really happened to Mike once the divorce was official and there was no longer spousal privilege. Their plan worked. Brian freaked out and repeatedly called Denise. When she refused to answer his calls, Brian decided to kidnap her before she could turn on him. On August 5th, Brian hid in Denise's car with a gun. When she got inside, he held the gun to her ribs and told her to drive somewhere remote and private. But Denise did not listen and instead drove to a drugstore parking lot. As they sat there, Brian screamed at Denise to stop crying because people would notice. She asked Brian if he planned on killing both of them, and he told her that he planned on killing himself. Denise had to get out of the situation, so she agreed with whatever Brian said. She told him things like, "I know that you love me." When Brian had calmed down, Denise drove him to his car and they parted ways. Denise realized Brian had what was essentially a kill kit with him in his backpack. Cleaning solution, a tarp, plus the gun. She realized that he had planned on killing her. This was possibly not just a suicidal threat. I'm going to pause now to hear a final word from today's sponsors. Are you feeling burned out? How do you handle it? It's not always work. Many parts of our daily lives can cause burnout, and BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you to prioritize yourself. Talking with someone can help you figure out what is causing the stress in your life. It has been an amazing service for me with all that I've been through in the last few years, mainly post-surgery depression, which I didn't even know was a thing until it happened to me. And throwing myself into work can and has caused some career burnout. I am using BetterHelp to get through this too because I love my job and I know it is a matter of balance and talking through it with someone I trust. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp and Southern Fried True Crime listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/southern. That's BETTERHELP.com/southern. Just like your skin, your hair is completely unique and deserves products that address its specific needs. That's why I think you'll love Function of Beauty. Function of Beauty is the world's first fully customizable hair care that creates individually filled shampoos, conditioners, styling, and treatment formulas based on your hair now and where you want it to go. Here's how it works. First, take the quick hair quiz to build your hair profile and select 5 hair goals like lengthen, volumize, and oil control. Does your hair get frizzy in the winter but oily in the summer? Function formulations are meant to be changed when your needs change. Next, choose your color and fragrance, or go dye or fragrance free. Then get your freshly filled formula delivered straight to your door and prepare for good hair days ahead. Say goodbye to generic hair care for good today. Go to functionofbeauty.com/SFTC to take your hair goals quiz and you'll save 25% on your first order. Go to functionofbeauty.com/SFTC to let them know you heard about it from our show and to get 25% off your first order. That's functionofbeauty.com/SFTC to take your hair quiz and save 25% off your first order. As soon as she could, Denise reported the kidnapping to county police. While she made a statement, an officer contacted FDLE detectives to see if they wanted to interview Denise. Of course, they jumped at the opportunity. FDLE Special Agent Mike Devaney and Tallahassee Police Officer David McCrane entered the room to interview Denise. After some small talk, McCrane, who is also Denise's brother-in-law, by the way, said they wanted to talk about Mike. He told her, quote, "I know, Denise, he did it, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, and he held that over your head forever. He was going to kill you so that you did not talk about him later. That is the truth. 15 years ago, he walked in and told you he had done something, didn't he?" Denise told McCrane that she didn't think Brian killed Mike, otherwise she would not have married him or wanted so badly to have children with him. McCrane did not believe her. He said, quote, "He killed Mike, and I'm pretty sure the reason he was going to kill you today was he was afraid you were going to say something." With the conversation going nowhere, Devaney told her, quote, "I was hoping you could fill in some of the pieces of the puzzle. You haven't. We arrested Brian, and he might, okay? Think about what I've said." But Denise, denied any knowledge she had about Mike's disappearance. At Brian's arraignment for kidnapping, domestic assault, and armed burglary charges, Denise read a statement asking the judge to deny bond. She said, quote, "I can't sleep. I can't eat because all I feel is the gun in my ribs, because I only hear his voice screaming at me." Brian Winchester was denied bond. With Brian behind bars, Mike's family and friends were hopeful they would finally get answers. But as the months passed with no new information, they started to lose hope. Brian ended up pleading no contest to the charges against him, and on December 19, 2017, his sentencing hearing was held. The prosecution told the judge that Brian should receive 45 years because it was clear his plan was a murder-suicide. The only reason Brian had not killed Denise and himself is because Denise foiled the plan. Denise was hoping Brian would get life. She read a statement aloud during the hearing, which read in part, quote, "He will finish what he has started no matter what age he is when he is released. I am asking you to sentence him to life in prison for the crimes he has committed. It comes down to my life or his, and I am asking you, please, choose mine." The defense argued that Brian should receive the 10-year minimum because on the day of the kidnapping incident, he was suicidal over multiple things: the divorce, his mother's recent terminal cancer diagnosis, and his son's decision to move in with Kathy after finding pictures of his father with sex workers. Brian read a statement as well, quote, "Never ever did I have any intentions of harming Denise, nor would I. Nonetheless, I do know that she was hurt by my actions, and again, I am truly sorry." In the end, the judge sentenced Brian to 20 years in prison and 15 years of probation. There was never a mention of Mike Williams, which left friends and family heartbroken. It seemed as if they were never going to get answers. Mike's boss, Clay, told 48 Hours, "Brian was shackled at the waist and the ankles, and when they shuffled him off to prison, we felt so defeated. We said, there'll never be an answer for our friend Mike. Never an answer. We won't know." But then, the day after Brian's sentencing, authorities announced they had found Mike's body under 6 feet of mud at Carr Lake, a rural, marshy, isolated area only 50 miles from Lake Seminole and 5 miles from Cheryl's house in Tallahassee. Cheryl later told A&E's Cold Case Files about what it was like to find out her son was located. Quote, "All that time, I was looking for a child who was alive, and they tell me he's dead. He's been dead for 17 years. Part of me just died that day." Authorities revealed that Mike was a victim of homicide, but they didn't say anything else. They didn't mention any persons of interest or how they were led to Carr Lake. It was later revealed that it took 5 days of digging to locate Mike's body. The process was arduous because they had to constantly hold back the water, which would fill in the newly dug holes. There was also an abundance of water moccasins and eels, which were difficult to spot in the murky water. Authorities later revealed that after arresting Brian for kidnapping Denise, they took the opportunity to see what he knew about Mike's disappearance. The prosecution told Brian they would offer him a deal. In exchange for a full, truthful confession, he would essentially receive immunity. In addition, the prosecution would cut him a deal on his charges stemming from the Denise incident. If he pleaded guilty or no contest, they would not seek a life sentence or introduce certain evidence at his sentencing hearing. Brian accepted the deal and explained that he and Denise started having an affair on October 13, 1997. On that evening, Brian, Kathy, Mike, and Denise had gone on a double date to see a Sister Hazel concert. Mike and Kathy dropped Denise and Brian off at the venue and then went to park the car. When they were alone, Denise and Brian kissed and then started making out. After the concert, they went back to their respective homes, but spent the night on the phone, talking, and having phone sex. Brian said, quote, "We just connected like nobody else. It snowballed really fast. The more we were together, the more we wanted to be together. Overall, it was very mutual." They usually hooked up at Denise and Mike's house, which wasn't hard to do considering Mike was a workaholic. His boss, Clay, told 48 Hours, quote, "He was an unbelievable worker. It was not uncommon for him to do 15-hour days. I mean, he would be there early, work until 1 or 2 in the morning, and then be right back. He had incredible energy." Around a year into the affair, Brian and Denise considered themselves to be in a relationship with each other. They wanted to be together. They wanted out of their marriages. But it wasn't that easy. Denise, who came from a religious family, was, quote, "ultra concerned with how she appeared to the world." So divorce was not an option. She also didn't want to share custody of her daughter with Mike. So, with no other option, they continued having the affair, wishing the day would come where they could be together. It was around March 2000 when Denise realized they could not keep having the affair. Because divorce was off the table, Denise told Brian there was only one other solution. Mike had to die. The idea snowballed, and before long, they were actively planning Mike's murder. Within a few months, Brian and Denise decided to add the element of insurance fraud. Denise then encouraged Mike to purchase the $1 million life insurance policy through Brian, bringing the total payout to $1.75 million. Brian said, quote, "We wanted to be together, but the money was just the icing on the cake." Brian and Denise brainstormed different ways to kill Mike. They came up with the option of staging a robbery gone wrong at his office, but ultimately decided it was a bad idea because robbery would bring a criminal investigation. And let's be honest, they were right. There was no criminal investigation into his disappearance for years. At one point, Denise suggested a plan where she and Brian kill both Mike and Kathy. They could go out in a boat on the Gulf of Mexico, push Mike and Kathy overboard, then go back to shore and say there had been an accident. I just want to point out here the hypocrisy of Denise. She claims she's religious, but she's really only devout in appearances. She would have been perfectly fine killing two innocent people to get what she wanted, so long as her family and the church did not find out. But anyway, Brian told Denise that he didn't want to leave his son without a mother, so they continued with the original plan to just kill Mike. They kept spitballing ideas until Brian recalled a previous hunting trip in Arkansas where Mike got stuck in quicksand and Brian had saved him. The memory gave Brian an idea. What if they staged a hunting accident gone wrong? It was totally plausible since it almost happened before. According to an appeal document, Brian told investigators that Denise liked this particular plan because Mike's survival would be up to God. She could feel better about herself if it were more like an accident and less like a murder. Denise agreed to the plan and they started setting everything in motion. Brian said Denise didn't, quote, have to do a whole lot other than come up with an alibi for herself and make sure that Mike went. By November 2000, Mike definitely knew something was going on with his wife. During a 20-hour road trip to Arkansas, Mike confided in Brian about his concerns. Denise had been refusing to have sex with him, and he was really upset about it. When Brian told Denise about his conversations with Mike, she started worrying that things were going to blow up soon. Denise told Brian that they needed to get rid of Mike sooner rather than later. Mike's $500,000 life insurance policy was set to expire soon. She already paid to extend it through the end of 2000, and she couldn't do it again. Also, her 18-month-old daughter Ansley was getting older. Denise did not want her to remember what happened to her father. Brian and Denise decided that Mike would be killed on December 9th. Brian would take Mike hunting really early in the morning, drown him in the lake, then go hunting with his father-in-law as a way of establishing an alibi. Denise planned to stay home with Ansley and make a few phone calls from the house to prove she had been at home. On the night before the hunting trip, Mike called Brian to say that Denise did not want him to go in the morning. Later, when it was safe, Brian called Denise to see what was going on. She said she had gotten cold feet. Following that night, Brian and Denise had several other conversations about if they should go through with their plan. Brian told her, quote, "Either we're going forward with this or we're not. This isn't something you need to be wishy-washy about." Ultimately, Denise agreed that they should go through with the murder. She was supposed to leave with Mike on their anniversary trip in the afternoon hours of December 16th. He would have to be killed before then because she didn't want to go. To finalize their plan, Brian called his father-in-law and set up a hunting date for the morning of December 16th so he would have an alibi. Brian then asked Mike if he wanted to go hunting at a secret spot he had found on Lake Seminole. They would need to bring their waders. Because Mike was supposed to head out on his anniversary trip, Brian suggested that they go in the very early morning hours. After checking with Denise, who encouraged him to go, Mike said he was available. Brian just had one more thing to do: make sure Kathy would not realize he was leaving the house much earlier than expected to meet her father. So, on the evening of December 15th, Brian and Kathy went to a concert. Kathy had a few drinks, which meant that when they got home, she fell asleep hard, hard enough that Brian could easily sneak out of bed unnoticed. In the early morning hours of December 16th, Brian and Mike met at a gas station parking lot off the interstate. They did not ride to the lake together. Instead, Mike followed Brian. Normally, they would have talked on the phone during their drive. But Brian told Mike that his phone had died. He was lying. He didn't want police to be able to track his phone later. Once they were at the lake, Brian talked Mike into putting on his waders before they got into their hunting spot. Brian then started to navigate the boat out to the supposed secret spot. Brian told investigators that after they rowed off into the darkness, he made his way out to a deep area before he stopped the boat. He said, quote, "I don't remember exactly how I got him to stand up. I don't know if I pretended something was wrong with the motor or the weight in the boat was off or something, but I basically stopped the boat and got him to stand up. And when he did, I pushed him into the water." Because it was dark out, Brian couldn't see what was going on. Quote, "He was in the water and he was struggling and the motor of the boat was still running." Brian said, "I pulled off just a little bit to get away from him so that he couldn't reach back into the boat." Brian later realized that Mike had taken off his jacket and waders and made his way to a tree stump where he held on for dear life, begging his best friend to save him. Brian panicked and didn't know how to get out of the situation, so he loaded his shotgun and made circles around Mike in the stump. As he passed by, Brian shot Mike in the head. Mike went under the water, so Brian had to fish him out and drag him to the shoreline. Brian then ran back to the landing where he parked, got in his Suburban, and backed up to the shoreline. He put Mike's body in a dog crate in the back of the vehicle in an effort to contain as much blood as possible. Brian then pushed Mike's boat back into the lake. As he drove away, Brian broke down the shotgun and threw pieces out the window. He was panicking because the sun was coming up and he realized he wouldn't make it in time to meet Kathy's father for their hunting date. Brian said, "I decided the best thing for me to do was go back to my house and pretend that I had overslept. I drove home and was really, really hoping that Kathy was still asleep. I went into the house as quietly as I could. She was still asleep. I crawled back into the bed." Then he called his father-in-law and apologized for oversleeping and missing their hunting date. Now that he had an alibi established, Brian had to decide what to do with Mike's body. He found that Mike's blood was dripping out of his truck's tailgate onto his driveway. So he washed away the blood and got moving. He had been thinking about it all morning, but he ultimately decided to hide Mike's body. He knew the burial site, quote, had to be close and it had to be quick and it had to be obviously a location that he wouldn't be found. Brian then drove to Walmart and purchased a tarp and shovel and then took Mike's body to Carr Lake. Because it was dry at the time, he had to dig the hole at the edge of the lake bed. After he got around 2 feet down, Brian put Mike in the tarp in the hole, then filled the grave in with dirt. During the process, he was bitten by ants and started to worry their red sting marks would look suspicious later. At some point, Brian had to take a break when a man showed up to hunt deer. Brian spoke with the man, who had no idea what was going on. Then, after the man left, Brian made sure he was completely out of view before he continued burying Mike. Brian told investigators that since that day, he had traveled back to the gravesite numerous times to make sure Mike's body had not moved. He did think about moving the body in case the area was developed, but he never followed through. After burying Mike, Brian went to his parents' house to rinse the blood out of the back of his truck. But that didn't work, so he had to go to a car wash and use a pressure washer. That afternoon, Brian attended a Christmas party with his in-laws. When Brian was driving home, he received a call from his father, Marcus, who told him that Mike was missing. Brian, who pretended to be shocked, went with his father to the lake to search for Mike. That's when they found the boat and notified authorities. For the first few days following Mike's murder, Brian and Denise played it safe and did not speak. They waited longer to see each other in person. Brian said, "I remember being kind of nervous. I just knew it would be kind of weird to see her because of what we had done." But as the search went on, and long term as things got back to normal, we just kind of settled back into the same routines. Brian never told Denise what happened. For all she knew, the plan had gone off without a hitch, and Mike's body was at the bottom of the lake. Brian said he tried to tell Denise the truth once, but she didn't want to know. Quote, she preferred to live in La La Land, where she pretended she had nothing to do with it. Denise grew worried when investigators didn't locate Mike's body. Brian was really hoping they would find Mike's waders or the jacket in the lake, and that way they would assume he was dead, and the investigation would end. But 9 days passed, and investigators had not recovered anything from the lake besides Mike's boat. So Brian took matters into his own hands. He told officers, quote, I took a hat that was similar to a hat that Mike used, which was really distinctive. It had a weird-looking bill on it. When I was out there with another friend of mine, I threw it in the water in that area because I wanted to keep the people in that area, because I wanted the waders to be found. Even though investigators didn't find the waders or his life jacket, Denise filed a claim for Mike's insurance 19 days after he went missing. At this point, only Mike's boat and hat had been recovered. It wasn't enough evidence to convince authorities that Mike had actually drowned in the lake. Brian said, I felt like we needed to kind of lay low and not appear to be the eager widow ready to cash in her life insurance. I knew the longer it dragged out, the better it was going to be. We talked about that. Plus, the money was earning 8% interest, a rate they would never get at the bank. So leaving it alone was a win-win for everyone. But Denise seemed to really want the money. Luckily for her, the waders and life jacket were found, and Denise was able to have Mike declared dead. Not wanting to draw any suspicions, Denise dated numerous men while Brian and Kathy divorced. Then, when it was safe, Denise and Brian made their relationship public. Everything was fine at first, but over time they grew paranoid that they would be caught. The first major scare they had came a few years after Mike's murder. One day, Denise brought Ansley over to visit Cheryl. While there, Denise found one of Cheryl's notebooks. Inside, Denise saw that Cheryl had many suspicions that she and Brian were involved. Denise really freaked out about it, and soon after, Cheryl was no longer allowed to see Ansley. Then, a few years after that, investigators asked Brian to come in for an interview. He said, "It became quite clear to me from that interview that they were suspicious of what happened, and not only that, they were suspicious of me and Denise." Following the police interview, Brian and Denise convinced themselves that authorities were surveilling them and tapping their phones. They decided that if they needed to talk about the mic situation, they would use hand signals to each other, a C for Cheryl, and two clenched fists for prison bars. They would then meet in a park, leave their phones in the car, then pat each other down before talking. Brian said that all of the tension plus his sex addiction led to their marriage breaking down. After he and Denise split, Brian pretty much lost it and grew very paranoid that Denise was going to turn him in for the murder. When investigators came to visit him in August 2016, Brian was positive that Denise had turned on him. That's when he kidnapped her. When Brian was finished confessing, State Attorney's Office investigator Jason Newland asked, "Does it ever get to you?" Brian responded, quote, "Every day, man, every day. I regret it. Everything. It affected me a lot more than Denise because Denise has an uncanny ability to live in denial." He went on, "It's weird, man, when you live a certain way over a time period and you act like something is the truth, it's almost like you begin to believe it." With Brian's bombshell confession, investigators started building their case against Denise. I'm going to pause now for a final commercial break. Luckily for detectives, Denise made a few suspicious choices. According to an appeal document, around a week after Brian was arrested for the kidnapping, Denise called Kathy and asked her to tell Marcus, Brian's father, to get a message to Brian that I'm not talking. Then, Kathy started working as an informant for the police and recording phone conversations she had with Denise. During one call, Kathy lied to Denise by saying she had been subpoenaed to testify about what she knew about Brian and Denise. Kathy told her, quote, "I've always just pretended like I don't know anything, and I do know." Denise quickly interjected, "What do you know?" While crying, Kathy said she knew Denise and Brian were having an affair before Mike disappeared. She said, quote, "I've always thought to myself, if I had said, Mike, I think Brian has a girlfriend. I've always wondered if he would still be here. Why couldn't you all have just gotten a divorce? I've always known you loved each other." Kathy wasn't lying either. She had suspected Brian was having an affair starting in 1999. She later testified, quote, "Whenever it was just me and Brian with Denise, it was uncomfortable. I felt like a third wheel. I felt like I was on a date with the two of them." In another call, Kathy lied again by telling Denise that she knew all about the plan to murder Mike. Kathy said that at one point, Brian was so mad that he called and told her everything. There was one thing in common with all the calls. No matter what Kathy said, Denise never denied having anything to do with Mike's disappearance. Instead, she just seemed overly concerned with what Brian may have told Kathy. On May 8, 2018, Denise was finally arrested and charged with being a principal to first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. Mike's boss, Patty, told 48 Hours that she was glad to see that Denise was arrested while wearing, quote, "an ugly dress and hair that needed a dye job." Patty said, quote, "I gotta tell ya, that felt pretty good to me, 'cause I know how important appearances are to her." On December 11, 2018, opening statements for Denise's trial began. The prosecution told the jury, "Denise likes the sound of being a widow much more than being a divorcee. Obviously, you can't be caught with a murder. So they had to make it look like an accident." Brian was the prosecution's star witness. He testified about how he killed Mike. It was the first time Cheryl heard what happened to her son. Throughout Brian's testimony, Denise sat emotionless as she heard the brutal details of how her husband was murdered. Later, during closing statements, the prosecution said, "Everybody in this entire room was moved by the sheer horror of that situation, except for one person. That one person sat here, absolute stone-faced, didn't bat an eye, didn't shed a tear. That lady right here, Miss Denise Williams, is guilty. The defense told the jury that Denise was completely innocent. She had no idea Brian was planning the murder or that he had committed it. There was no physical evidence tying Denise to the crime, and she had never confessed to anyone about killing Mike. The only person tying her to the murder is Brian, the real killer who was able to strike a deal with the state. The defense told the jury, quote, "He testified as he pleased about this without any fear that the state will be able to use that testimony against him. He has a motive to lie to you. He has a motive to make up this accusation against her. He didn't mention anything about her alleged participation in this murder until he realized he was facing a life sentence in this kidnapping, and after he realized she was going to go into court and ask for a life sentence." The defense said Brian was seeking revenge against Denise. On cross-examination, Brian admitted to being a liar and a murderer. He had received immunity for his confession. However, he didn't lie because, quote, "It was made explicitly clear to me by the five attorneys that I had helping me on my case that if I decided to go forth and give a proffer and give information about the Mike Williams case, that I absolutely, positively needed to tell the truth." On December 14th, 2 days shy of the 18th anniversary of Mike's murder, the jury found Denise guilty on all charges after deliberating for 8 hours. Cheryl's hard work had finally paid off. Ansley Williams, then 19 years old, testified in court, pleading for leniency for her mother. She insisted that her stepfather Brian, and not Denise, was the mastermind behind her father's murder in December of 2000. The defense had been so confident they would get an acquittal that they didn't want the jury to consider lesser charges. Cheryl Williams read a statement about her granddaughter Ansley, who she had not seen since she was 5 years old. She told the judge, quote, "Not only did Denise murder my son, she stole my granddaughter from me. For her entire life, Ansley was raised in a house with the murderers of her father, while being denied the love of her father's family. She was told that Grandma Cheryl was crazy and would hurt her. I don't know if I will ever have Ansley in my life again because of the damage her mother has done." She continued, quote, "Judge, I am asking you to lock Denise up for the rest of her life with no chance of parole. She has already lived 18 years longer than my son. She got to watch Mike's daughter grow up. I didn't. Please don't allow Denise to ever be around any of her future grandchildren, because one generation of Williams children growing up around murderers is enough." She told the judge, "For the rest of my life, when I sleep at night, I picture my son clinging to a tree stump in Lake Seminole in the dark, knowing that his best friend is trying to kill him. I hear his voice screaming for help. I wasn't there to help him. It will haunt me forever." Denise was sentenced to life in prison for murder and 30 years for conspiracy. She appealed her conviction and life sentence, and in November 2020, the Florida District Court of Appeals overturned her murder conviction and life sentence on the grounds that she wasn't a principal participant to first-degree murder. There was no evidence that Denise was physically present at the scene of the murder or any place nearby, or that she counseled or hired Brian to murder Mike. For those reasons, she wasn't a principal participant. However, the court agreed there was enough evidence to uphold Denise's conspiracy conviction. The state appealed the court's decision, but their motion was denied. Today, Brian is incarcerated in the Madison Correctional Institute in Madison, Florida. His current release date is July 30th, 2036. He will be 67 years old. Denise is incarcerated in the Florida Women's Reception Center in Ocala, Florida. Her release date is April 25, 2047. She will be 78 years old. State Attorney Investigator Tully Sparkman told Annie's Cold Case Files that he does not believe Denise has ever told anyone the truth about her role in Mike's murder. He also said that without Cheryl, Mike's case most likely would have been closed for good, and no one would have found out what really happened. Sadly, as of this recording, and as far as Haley and I could find, Cheryl has not had contact with her granddaughter. She told A&E that there's a million things she wants Ansley to know about her daddy, but the thing she wants her to know the most is that he loved her more than life itself. There is a legal principle saying that justice delayed is justice denied. I think this is one of those cases where that saying comes to mind. Cheryl Williams didn't just lose a son, she lost her granddaughter. She spent almost 2 decades begging law enforcement and even the governor for help. She certainly isn't the only family of a missing person to show such tenacity. But she is proof that advocacy works. In her case, she is so right. Her granddaughter was raised by her son's murderers. As if his vicious murder was not bad enough, she had to sit back as her ex-daughter-in-law estranged her from Ansley, suspecting all along that Denise knew what happened to Mike. I cannot imagine living with that kind of anguish, the unknowing, and the one comfort to her would probably have been Mike's only child, his daughter Ansley, and she was cruelly cut off from her. Ansley is now a grown woman, and she has cut off media interviews, so we can't be totally sure of how she feels about her grandma. She attended Florida State University and also competed in Miss Florida USA after being crowned Miss Tallahassee. Ansley chose to remain in her hometown. In 2019, she was awarded some $877,000 by the insurance company, as well as 4 pieces of real estate, including her parents' home in Centennial Oaks Circle. The insurance company agreed to release the money and assets to Ansley on the condition that she could not use the money or assets to assist in her mother's legal bills or pending appeals. If she breaks the conditions of the agreement, the state could order her to pay $150,000 in damages. But all the money and homes in the world cannot replace your mom and dad. They cannot repair the emotional damage of the lies her mother told her. At least Brian confessed. Denise is continuing to emotionally damage her daughter by continuing to lie about her involvement. Just this past September in 2021, Ansley was still begging the court for leniency for her mother during an automatic resentencing. When Denise's murder conviction was overturned, she had to be sentenced again on the other charge. Cheryl Williams also addressed the court saying, quote, "Please don't show her any mercy. She did not show my son any mercy. She took him away from his daughter, family, and friends." After Denise's 30-year sentence was upheld, Cheryl did say she finally felt she had justice. She had been living in fear for 3 years that Denise's sentence would be reduced. Knowing she will serve her time did bring her some relief. But it will not repair her relationship with her granddaughter. Only time can do that. We can only hope and pray that Cheryl and Ansley can one day be reunited. If not, Mike's murder will continue to reverberate and traumatize the next generation. Mike Williams was such a loving family man. It is heartbreaking to think the tragedy of his murder will continue to haunt his family. He would want them to heal and be happy. Southern Fried True Crime is hosted and produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was written and researched by Haley Gray, with additional writing by me. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. Oh my God, now it is storming cats and dogs out there, y'all. But I made it through the episode, yay. Okay, thanks to everyone who suggested this case. It's been a popular request for years, so it's impossible to name each of you, but I really appreciate your interest. It was definitely a compelling case. If you have any other case suggestions, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com and go to the listener suggestion tab. And if you have submitted a case suggestion in the last few months, please resubmit it on the website. This is the best way for me to get to those little-known cases y'all always send me. Please remember that I do not accept suggestions on social media private messages. With 3 platforms to manage, that is very overwhelming for me. I hope you understand. But please come join our Facebook group, Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group, where we swap recipes, worship Dolly Parton, and share memes. I much prefer spending my social media time in our lovely group. We do, of course, discuss true crime, not just Southern fraud, but all kinds, but it is still very much a Southern lifestyle group. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook, and by God, we mean it when we say no shit ass is allowed. It's not just a motto, it's how we run the group. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I am also on all large platforms like iHeart, Stitcher, and Spotify. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.